Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
901 Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score, 670thescore.com. It is Nick Szczepkowski and Anthony Herron with you. Another hour to go here on The Score tonight. 312-644-6767 is your telephone number to call. Text messages always welcome as well. 67011 is where you go to send those. So today in the Cubs game, they fall behind early. Very early, in fact. 1-0 at the end of the first inning, because all Kyle Hendricks does is give up first inning runs. His ERA north of 7 in the first inning. Give up another run in the second, but then Hendricks was shut it down type of stuff. Goes 6 innings, allows just 2 runs in this one. Again, didn't leave with the lead, but pitched well enough for the Cubs to be in the ballgame. The problem was today, if you missed the Cubs game, through 5 innings and 2/3, they were without a hit. They were without really threatening anything. They started off the game, Anthony Rizzo took a walk, Javier Baez jumped out to a 3-0 count, and they did not produce a run that inning. Hell, they didn't produce a hit for the first however long in that game. So they're batting bottom of the 6th inning. Nothing's going the Cubs' way. There's 2 outs. They flip the order. Anthony Rizzo comes up for the 3rd time in the contest, and to me, what I think is the most demoralizing thing that can happen to a pitcher in a baseball game, that's what Anthony Rizzo provided to Jeremy Hellickson with 2 outs in the bottom of the 6th.
And here comes Rizzo now looking for his 1,000th career base hit. Rizzo takes inside, Rick. Ball 1. Rizzo swings and misses. The count 1-1. The 1-1 to Rizzo takes inside, almost nailed him in the right arm. 2-1, and now the 2-1 from the right-hander. Rizzo takes a strike at the knees, 2-2, and the 2-2 now to Rizzo. Anthony swings and fouls it at the plate. Here comes the 2-2 now to Rizzo. Anthony pokes it foul off to the left, out of play. 2-2 to Anthony, line foul off to the left, out of play. Anthony working hard, making Hellickson work very hard. The windup in the 2-2. Rizzo hits another foul out of play. Here comes the 2-2. Rizzo fouls yet another one away. And now the 2-2 from Jeremy Hellickson. Rizzo takes inside.
By far the best at bat a Cubs hitter has had today.
The count is full. Cubs looking for their first hit of the day, and Rizzo drives it foul off to the right, out of play. Here's the 3-2 to Anthony. Fouled away again, and Rizzo takes ball 4.
And that's how you heard it, right here on 670 The Score. Bottom of the 6th inning, Anthony Rizzo works a 13-pitch at bat, taking every best offering Jeremy Hellickson had, wasting him away, following him down the line, eventually walks after 13 pitches. What that leads to is, immediately, Javier Baez has walked on 4 pitches. Following him was Ben Zobrist, walked on 4 more pitches. And before you could blink, Jeremy Hellickson exited the game, but despite not allowing a hit, the Cubs come through after the Cubs get Jason Heyward an RBI single that tied up the ball game there in the 6th. The game was tied, and despite not allowing a hit, Hellickson left the game without a chance to win it either after his base runners were on base and scored the tying run in that game. And to me, when you are giving your best offering to the most feared hitter in a lineup, and that's what Rizzo is right now with the Cubs and with Bryant being hurt and not in the lineup, when you're giving your best effort, when you're giving your best stuff, and you simply cannot find an out pitch, and that hitter's up there reminding you of it every time you come back with something you think, all right, he's not going to get this, wastes it away. Best offering, wastes it away again. And next thing you know, 10, 13 pitches later, all of a sudden you might have a no-hitter going, but you're in your own head because you're like, oh, my best stuff's not getting by somebody now. Like, that to me is the most demoralizing thing that can happen to a pitcher in a baseball game. It's not giving up a first pitch 450-foot shot. Okay, I tried to beat him with a fastball, and I didn't beat him with a fastball. This is, I tried to beat him with everything. Everything that I have, I tried to come up with, and I could not get it by him. And he ended up beating me. This one wasn't a home run that he worked. This was a walk. And it got so much inside Hellickson, it wore him out so much as well, that he couldn't find the strike zone the next two batters. And to me, that is just the most demoralizing thing that can happen to a pitcher. So I want to know for you, baseball, basketball, football, hockey, I guess soccer, even though my expertise in that goes nowhere, what's the most demoralizing thing that you can do to an opponent? 312-644-6767, because the Cubs look dead in the water up until that at-bat. After that at-bat, the Nationals look dead in the water. Hell, their fielding didn't even look good, because it went beyond just getting into Hellickson's head. It was like, oh my God, after that at-bat, nothing could go the Nationals' way. And I'm curious to know what your thoughts are at 312-644-6767. Because to me, that was the equivalent of, and I know you've been on teams that played this way. Hell, I was on high school teams that played this way, of where you're not allowing a big play running the ball. You just can't find the stop. Right. You're allowing 4 yards a pop. It's third and two, and you know in the back of your head, you're like, know exactly what's coming, know exactly what hole it's going to, and we know that it's going to be first and 10 here in a matter of seconds because we are not going to get a stop here. It felt like a team that's just pounding the ball down your throat and you can do nothing about it.
And that third down moment during a football game is worse than if a team goes for fourth down, because if a team goes for fourth down and converts it, especially if they can convert it for a touchdown, you're getting off the field. Or, you know, fourth down is such a unique situation as a defender in football, because teams don't go, you know, people go for fourth downs on occasion, even more so than they do now. But third downs, there are periods in practice pretty much every day when you're having your more spirited practices of the week where you're working on third down. Fourth down is a more unique scenario that you don't prepare for like you do for third down, because third downs you expect to see on a consistent basis in football. It's when you got to get off the field, and for offenses, that's when you need to convert to move the chains. So that, from a football standpoint, would be the most demoralizing. You know, it's different than giving up a big run, especially a touchdown run where you're getting off the field, or a big pass play where you can look at it and say, well, okay, there's that one mistake, blew coverage, got out of our gap, and you can go back and try to assess that once you get to the sideline. But converting to third down means we thought we were off the field. It means, yeah, the crowd got all amped up if you're the home team, and now here we are. They've converted it, and now the entire stadium is deflated, and you got to come out here and you got to continue to play and get yourself jacked back up again. So from a football standpoint, I would definitely say giving up that third down conversion is a really big moment like that.
815 texter points out there was another one that was very demoralizing for the Nationals later in the game, and that was the pickoff. With two on, nobody out in the top of the eighth inning, Nationals looked like they were going to be threatening, looked like they were going to be at least tying up that ball game. And instead, you see quickly Juan Soto get picked off of first, and because of a nice back pick by Rizzo and Contreras, a great play, great catch by Rizzo, and an even better tag to kind of make that play all go. And all of a sudden, it went from two on, nobody out, to one on and one out, and then the hitter gets himself out on a fly ball, and all of a sudden it was two outs and a guy on third base, which didn't feel all that threatening based off of how the inning had begun. Yeah, I think that's a good one. I just think that that whole game turned today after Rizzo's at bat of, okay,
yeah,
yep, things are back to normal here, because Rizzo just worked in at bat like he can. He took the best shot from this pitcher, and he's got absolutely nothing left, and it led to an inning that was a memorable one for the Cubs.
Well, you think about the pitch count, too. I mean, going in, like, through five innings, the pitch count was really under control for Hellickson. It looked like he had a shot at maybe going nine, and once you got him into that sixth, it made a difference. Those 13 pitches and the way it went down were – and for some reason, Rizzo, it seemed like, was seeing him well throughout the day, because the opening bat of the game that he had,
walked,
the opening at-bat, he walked him. So it seemed like he kind of had a bead on him throughout the game. So it ended up being really big. I agree. That was the turning point in the game today to get Hellickson out of there. It's not like they weren't making any contact. They hit him hard a few times, but they just couldn't, especially the hitters other than Rizzo, couldn't necessarily kind of figure out whatever the puzzle was they were trying to solve with Hellickson.
Yeah, I threw this out on Twitter as well, and some people are chiming in on the conversation. They're saying 2 goals in 17 seconds to lose a Stanley Cup on your home ice is pretty demoralizing. Yeah, that's extreme circumstances, but that is about as bad as I would think it would get. You go from thinking if you're a Boston Bruins fan back in June of 2013, thinking, all right, we're headed to a Game 7. Anything goes into Game 7, it's a flip of a coin to... All right, well, we're playing for overtime here and hopefully can force that Game 7 to, oh, forget overtime. They're about to have a trophy ceremony on this very ice. That's got to be pretty damn demoralizing. I mean, it's such a freak thing, though. It's not something that can happen in the middle of August in a regular season game. But, yeah, that's a pretty damn good example of the most demoralizing things you've seen in sports. What about yourself? 312-644-6767. Some people chiming in here on the Twitter line as well. At Shep670 is where you can follow me. At Big Ant Heron is where you can follow Anthony Heron as well. Some people keep tweeting me the gif of the Tyronn Lue getting stepped over by Allen Iverson. And it's like, that's embarrassing? But you remember how the rest of that series went after Allen Iverson did that?
Ran off four straight
Lakers
games.
Won Lakers won four did. Straight, and it's like, okay. Yeah, it's embarrassing on your home court, and you live in gif form forever. But also, Tyronn Lue can say, hey, AI... See this ring?
Hardware.
Something you're still looking for in your NBA career. How about yourself? 312-644-6767. Southside Tom has a thought on what's pretty demoralizing. What's up, Tom?
Hey, what's going on, fellas?
What's happening?
Not much. I'd say, you know what, embarrassment's one thing, but when you're trying to take somebody's career out, that's when I think it gets really demoralizing. And that's where we're coming with, you know, somebody with spikes, you know, trying to spike somebody, take their knee out, low-blowing somebody on the football field, you know, trying to hit them with your head. That's when I think it's real demoralized because now you're messing with the whole person's family, their careers, and that's when I think...
Yeah, I think it's dirty. Personal. I think it's embarrassing. I think it's pathetic in most cases. But
even with that, it's almost more embarrassing to the person who's attempting to do it.
Sure.
When, especially if it's obvious that individual did something dirty. And in some ways, if you don't end up injuring the guy who you attempted to do something dirty to, then it can be an emotional boost because then there's that extra anger or aggression that kind of takes over to come back from it. So I kind of hear what Tom's trying to go there, but I think the reaction to it isn't always as consistent.
I always like when you see a receiver or sometimes a running back get smoked and either they make the catch, sometimes they don't, but they get up and they do the little like wipe the dirt off their shoulder type thing of like, hey, we're good to go. And it's like, all right, our guy just got rocked and he's ready to rock. So that makes me, that fires me up even a little bit more. Like I always like that as a teammate when you'd see that or you see it even college games, pro games of this day of you see someone just get laid out and their immediate response is, all right, I didn't make the catch this time, but I'm up and I'm ready to take your best shot. You better come at me twice as hard next time because I'm going to continue to get up and I'm going to continue to beat your ass along the way.
The step back three, that one's become a lot more demoralizing than it used to be and really largely because the step back three didn't really exist in large quantities until Steph Curry made it more prominent and prevalent here in recent years. But the step back three has kind of become like the dunk in a way. I think it's not quite on the dunk level yet when you really get somebody good with a nice dunk. But the step back three has become a far more demoralizing thing than it used to be because you don't have these three-point specialists like there were in the 80s and the 90s when we were kind of coming up watching basketball with our generation of fans and what was happening with the Bulls. You don't have to be a specialist anymore. The main scorers are now the guys trying to do the Steph Curry thing, just cross somebody up, step back, hit a deep three. And when you get them, especially if you kind of, you know, rock them to sleep real quick and a guy falls on the ground from a crossover and then you hit the three in their eyeball, that's become almost as demoralizing as just when you dunk on them and your groin is in their noggin. That used to be kind of the main way to demoralize somebody in hoops.
Yeah, it's one thing to get dunked on, and then the others of just when you play good defense, when you hold a Golden State Warriors or a Steph Curry and you keep your guy in front of you, all right, you're not getting around me, And they do, like, it's almost like a cheat code of, like, step back. It's like, yeah, you played great defense for 20 seconds. It's that last four that I stepped back, crossed you over, and that last four still counted just the same, and we got three more points because of it. And I think that that's a pretty damn good example basketball-wise. Football-wise to me, it's like I said, not getting off the field on third down or a team that's just is owning the line of scrimmage and you know third and two and you don't have a chance of stopping them is just a kick to the nuts the entire drive. Baseball-wise, to me, it's those long at-bats like Anthony Rizzo. Hell, that's what stirred the whole conversation. What about yourself? What's the most demoralizing thing, team-wise, team sport-wise, that can happen to you? 312-644-6767. Nick Szczepkowski, Anthony Herron, discussing just this. Going to get in some Cubs-Nationals talk as well before 10 o'clock. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
It's outside. Throw to first base, and they've got him picked off. Soto gets picked off by Contreras. Rizzo cutting behind the rookie. Rizzo caught the throw. There was a tangle of arms and legs. Rizzo caught the ball and made the tag. And that is going to be the first out in the inning, and it's a huge out.
That's how you saw it go, as the Nationals looked like they were going to be threatening there in the eighth inning. Instead, Juan Soto gets picked off. And before you knew it, the Cubs were out of that jam, still holding the lead 3-2 there in the eighth. Welcome back in. Nick Szczepkowski, Anthony Herron with you. 670 The Score, 670thescore.com. Based off of that, that was pretty demoralizing for the Nationals. It killed that rally. I think the most demoralizing thing for the day, though, was Rizzo's 13-pitch at-bat that he works the walk, and Jeremy Hellickson was out of the game two batters later. Didn't throw a strike to either Javi Baez or Ben Zobrist, and left with the Cubs eventually tying up that game in the bottom of the seventh inning. For you, what's the most demoralizing thing in sports? Taking some texts, taking some tweets on it, and some phone calls as well at 312-644-6767 is your telephone number to call. As we continue this conversation, far northwest side, it's Joe next up on The Score. What's up, Joe?
Good evening, Shep and Anthony. Enjoying your show as always, but I'm glad to see the Cubs beat the Harper Valley PTA today, let me tell you. But that texter took the words out of my mouth late in the game, first and second, nobody out. Contreras, he's probably one of the best catchers in the National League that does that. He does it quite a bit. You know, sometimes it works. Today, it really worked for the Cubs, but it was great that the Cubs pulled it off today, but it was more of a ground game to me. You know, it was a psychology game, played well, you know, especially when Rizzo made that walk, you know, and got things going right then and there. But I'll give credit to Hendricks. I'm glad to see him coming back a little bit, you know, a couple earned runs in six innings. But speaking about demoralizing, you know, there's a couple of things here. I'm pretty accurate, but not exactly 100%. I think it was Harvey Haddix, one of the first one to hit a no-hitter going into twelfth inning or the 13th inning, where he ended up losing the game. He was with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Another demoralizing thing that happened, you guys could look into this one because I vaguely remember reading about it, where Babe Ruth tried to steal second during a World Series game and was caught out. He didn't steal second. I think it might have been the 28 World Series that ended the World Series. Now, that's something to look into because that's demoralizing. Well, have a good evening, guys.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, I don't remember Babe Ruth stealing the base to lose the World Series or get thrown out doing that. I do remember my dad used to always tell me about Harvey Haddix. 12 perfect innings, finally allows a run in the 13th and gets hit with a loss because no one wanted to pick up a bat for the Pirates that day. Like, maybe the best game ever pitched. Like, 36 up, 36 down. Like, yeah, that's not enough. Eh, go out there and do more, kid.
It was
just a kick to the – oh, man.
There was a game. The game that that Ron Dane broke the all-time rushing record.
The one where you had a hand on him at the line
right
of scrimmage.
There. So later in that
like,
game –
I'm good. I'm going to run past you.
Yeah,
and then Matt Bowen
much,
slowing –
yeah,
slow Bowen is one. Trying to chase him down and apparently jumps on the pile about 30 yards downfield.
But later in that same game – by the time that, you know, in the fourth quarter where Wisconsin's really certain they've got things in hand, you know, whatever, they're by whatever, probably three or four touchdowns at this point. And they moved on from Ron Dane. They moved on from giving carries to whoever their backup running back is. It got to the point, and if you've ever been to Camp Randall in Madison, you know what they tend to do. They definitely did it back then when Ron Dane was the back, where they, once the guy, the PA announcer, says the name of the ball carrier over the loudspeaker at Camp Randall, like, Ron Dane. And then the entire stadium repeats it, Ron Dane. They did the same thing when the backup was in.
It's not all that creative, but it's like, at least it's not. There's a timeout.
It's a moment.
Where? On the field. Oh, this bit was old 20 years ago.
And so it got to the fourth quarter in that game, and I still remember the name of this seemingly nameless running back who was in the game in the fourth quarter, and they were moving the ball on us with this dude too, because by that point we were that demoralized in the fourth. They had Matt Unertle in the game, and so over the loudspeaker he got the carry, and it was Matt "You Nerdle!" The entire stadium at Camp Randall, "Matt, you Nerdle!" And that just, I just remember the sinking feeling. It was one thing when the Heisman Trophy winner, all-time leading rusher, it was honestly the first good game Ron Dayne had ever had against us in his entire career. It's like, all right, Ron Dayne got us today. They're repeating Ron Dayne's name. All right, whatever. You got one today, Ron. By the time it gets to Matt, you Nerdle, being repeated over the loudspeaker because he's gaining chunk yards on you, that was about as low a feeling as I could have had on that particular day in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's rough when you're getting beaten up by the bench warmers and everything. Matt, you Nerdle. Herb, $50 if you can get Matt, you Nerdle on the phone to talk some smack to Anthony Heron before 10 o'clock. 312-644-6767, the telephone number to call as we'll continue this conversation. The most demoralizing things that can happen to you. Oak Lawn and Kevin next up on the score. Kevin's going to go the Grobstein route with us, citing something here, but I think he is a spot on and a perfect example of it. What's up, Kev?
Hey, I'm 66, so I'm going back a little bit. Game 7, NHL Championship, Hawks playing Canadiens at our building, and Tony Esposito lost it in the fog at the stadium, and Canadiens win.
Well, he gave up a goal, like, from center ice or something, right?
Right, from Henri Richard. Yeah, I remember that vividly.
Appreciate the telephone call there, Kevin. Yeah, that's the one Gropper always says. Hawks were up 2-0, and Tony O let a weak one in from center ice, and before you knew it, the Canadiens were skating around the Chicago Stadium with the Stanley Cup, and the Hawks wouldn't go on to win a cup again until 2010. That's one that Gropper always mentions, and just the way it kind of plays out. Listen, I was 15 years from being a thought in 1971. But that seems like a prime example of it. All right, here's a weak one, and there's air back in, there's oxygen back in the lungs of the Montreal Canadiens back then. Carol Stream and Robbie next up on the score. What's up, Rob?
And I'm going to tell you what was so demoralizing. One was in 03, sitting in the living room with my dad, okay? Lifelong Cubs fan, watching him watch the Cubs fall apart. Not just one game, but it was one game, game 6, that led to game 7, and watching the Cubs fall apart, it was demoralizing. You know, I saw my dad get so upset, and I just felt terrible for him. I was a high school teenager watching the Cubs fall apart and watching my dad just get really upset.
Robbie, appreciate the telephone call. I still say to this day, Moises Alou doesn't act like a 7-year-old who doesn't get their favorite toy from Toys R Us. That entire thing goes differently. You see a veteran who was brought in to be a leader, to be a difference maker, that fought through some of those battles with the Astros teams in the 90s, supposed to know what playoff baseball is about. He reacts that way. Rest of the team, it's not surprising a young Mark Pryor starts to come undone. Not surprising that you see Alex Gonzalez boot a routine grounder that should have been a double play that got them out of the inning. You have one of the veterans, supposed to be leaders of that team, react like a leader should instead of trying to place the blame and overreact and throw his glove and have a temper tantrum like a 7-year-old, like I said. Entire thing works out differently.
And like, you see, you know, he's reacting in the moment, and it's a huge game, and you got the whole, the curse is obviously still going at that point. You're trying to reverse it, and the Red Sox haven't even reversed their curse at that point. And so thinking back to that moment, the frustration had to be immense, especially because Moises Alou wasn't a great fielder anyway. So the fact that he hustled all the way over to the wall, and he's leaping up into the stands, and he thinks he's about to make this game-saving play here to get the out, get them out of that jam, and he didn't make it. So I get that he was really frustrated, but then, yeah, to direct his ire into the stands, I would think in retrospect, and, you know, he's maybe been quoted on it since then, who knows, but with everything, the fallout from that moment, from his team to what happened to Steve Bartman's life and all those types of things, I would think he wishes he had that moment back. He could have reacted better, should have reacted better, but I get in the moment where the frustration boils over because you want to make that play.
Yeah, you want to make that play. And didn't he, like, a couple of years ago, on the anniversary of it, I think NBC Sports Chicago did a documentary on whole Cubs, maybe it was in 2013 they put that together for the 10-year anniversary. Hmm. And he's like, oh, I didn't have a play on it anyway. Then why'd you react like you did, asswipe? Get the hell out of here, Moises Alou. Like, my goodness. Homer Glenn, Mike has an example of a demoralizing athletic accomplishment or feat. What's up, Mike and Homer Glenn?
Hey, guys. Love the show.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Listening to you guys on the third down play, as far as football goes, the most demoralizing thing I've ever seen is when Bo Jackson not only ran over Brian Bosworth into the end zone, he pretty much demoralized and demolished that guy's whole career after that. What do you think?
Yeah, that's all-time legendary college football player. Brian Bosworth, I don't know, what was he drafted overall? Whatever it was high. And Bo Jackson on Monday Night Football ran over him, through him,
ran through
whatever
his soul.
I mean,
there was just nothing left of the Boz after Bo Jackson got done with it. He was just Brian at that point. He wasn't the Boz anymore. He wasn't Brian Bosworth. He was just Brian.
It's the lightning bolts carved into the side of the head. Officially, they officially kicked the bucket after that night, I believe. That's taking the soul out of someone and making them never want to play football again. Yeah, Brian Bosworth was drafted by the Seahawks. Let's see here. He was first round, first overall in the 1987 NFL supplemental draft. So the Seahawks gave up what their first round pick would have been. I don't know what that was to get him. And he ended up playing in 24 NFL games, most known for NFL uniform, having Bo Jackson crush your soul. Is there one for you that you remember of like thinking you had a guy lined up and you're like, all right, I'm bringing so-and-so down. And there he goes running for 30 more yards.
No,
I give you crap about Ron Dane. Mm. It would have been an arm tackle for a guy that was like 250 pounds.
Yeah,
so that's not fair. But I do
and,
like.
And I didn't
crap
make any
I
contact with him on the particular. I mean, there's a clip somewhere of me lighting Ron Dane up in the backfield the year before that when they came to Iowa City and Keith Jackson was on the call and he like says my name like Anthony Herron. That was when I met Ron Dane one on one. Believe me, I won that battle. So that this one where he breaks the record is just me not quite getting off a block and he kind of turns the corner from my gap responsibility. But there was a moment in a game where Nebraska came to Kinnick where a teammate of mine, Eric Crouch, who ends up going on to win the Heisman the following season, but what burst Eric Crouch onto the scene was the game. Bobby Newcomb started the game. It was the season opener. Nebraska came to Kinnick in 99, and we were only trailing 7-0 at halftime. We had a nice D-line. We were shutting their option down. Bobby Newcomb, I think we forced like 3 fumbles on him in the first half. We were all over him. They put Eric Crouch in the second half, and Eric Crouch just ran all over us. And most of it was him being fast and elusive and turning the corner well. But there was one particular moment where even though he was the visiting team quarterback, where Eric Crouch turned the corner at Kinnick, burst out into open space, and like a good 15 yards downfield, one of our defensive backs tried to knock Eric Crouch out of bounds, and Crouch it probably would have been a penalty today. It should have been a felony. He lowered the boom on one of our DBs near the sideline and literally knocked the dude unconscious. Knocked him unconscious so bad that even though this Iowa DB was wearing a helmet at the moment, the rest of the week he actually had a knot on his head. It seems physically impossible, but Eric Crouch hit him so hard that he knocked him unconscious where the guy was trying to tackle him, and there was literally a welt on his head through the helmet for the rest of the following week where he couldn't even put his helmet on for the following game.
Oh, my God. Like I found this.
You did?
Yes. I don't know who I have no idea who the defender is.
Oh, I know who it is.
Maybe it is, and you're just being a great teammate two decades later and not selling him down. That makes what Bo Jackson did to Brian Bosworth look like a love tap.
And this is college game day.
Oh, my Lord.
College game day was just coming into its heyday at that point. This is like, mid to late-ish 90s. What was this? Maybe like this is late 90s. This is like 99. And so at this point, college game day was a big deal. It was really, that was where it finally picked up big-time steam. And so even the following week, where everybody's like, wow, check out this Eric Crouch guy. And that is the play that just kept getting replayed over and over and over again. And of course, we clowned my guy just nonstop because that's what you do when that type of highlight happens, even if against your teammate or your friend. When you get clowned, when you get demoralized on the field like that, that's just how athletics works. So he was not able to live that one down anytime soon.
312-644-6767. Before we take a timeout, North Aurora, Jeff next up on the score. What's up, Jeff?
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Good. Hey, Jeff.
Excellent. All right. First of all, the most demoralizing thing in sports is losing to a Hail Mary pass, i.e. the Saints last year. They thought they had it locked up, played some a little bit of prevent defense, don't let anybody get deep. Boom. Stephon Diggs ruins their day. No playoffs for New Orleans. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a horrible way to lose. I guess my idea of what I'm thinking of is something that can happen in a regular season game. And sure, you can lose on a Hail Mary in a regular season game, and you can look like fools doing it, and it can crush you for the weeks to come afterwards after losing in heartbreak fashion. But I guess, like, the prime example of losing in a divisional round and costing your team a shot at the conference championship, I think I was thinking more of, like, it can happen game one of the year, game 10 of the year, or in a playoff game. But that is, it didn't... I was not hoping the Vikings would win that game. Being a Bears fan growing, I've never been one to root for the Minnesota Vikings. Okay. So I wasn't thrilled when that happened, but I guess I was thrilled with the result ultimately of the NFC title game. So there was that, because the Vikings got run out of the building on that day. But yeah, in terms of how to lose a playoff game, that's a pretty damn bad one of thinking, all right, We're one play away from just have to knock a pass down on a Hail Mary and we'll be popping champagne and going to the NFC title to, oh, God, this is going to be a long flight home.
And you're thinking, how in the world did that really just happen to us? Because there's no way they expected that to happen. There's no way they thought they had a shot at still losing that game. You just need to make one simplistic play. The moment doesn't go in your favor, and the other team has no idea how they won. They just know that they can't believe that it happened in their favor, because you don't expect moments like that to happen on the football field or in sports in general, because they're so rare, so infrequent when they do.
That's Anthony Heron. I'm Nick Szczepkowski. What's the most demoralizing thing that can happen to you on an athletic field? 312-644-6767 is your telephone number to call. We're here until 10 o'clock. That's when Julie DeCaro will take over on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. 941 Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score, 670thescore.com. If you want to decide to release the name of your teammate that Eric Crouch put in intensive care, or at least looked like he put in intensive care, I will let you. Just reading some, I put it out on Twitter.
I can't stop watching.
If you're just joining us, it's Nick Szczepkowski, Anthony Heron with you tonight. It all got brought up because I was talking about the most demoralizing things that can happen to you as an athlete in a team sport. And I said, as a pitcher, when you are throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at a batter, and they keep falling off your best stuff, and eventually they work a walk, they work a base hit, they rip a homer, whatever the end result is negative towards you, the pitcher, and you're thinking, oh my God, no matter what I throw, I'm not getting this guy out. Started leading us down the road of what's the most demoralizing things that can happen. And Big Ant shared with us the play that Eric Crouch made on his teammate at Iowa, where he runs him over he makes contact at like the 10-yard line in this video and sends this guy.
And Eric Crouch isn't a big guy. It's not like this is Jerome Bettis turning the corner here.
He hits him at the 10 and he lands on the 5 and he's unconscious when he lands.
He lay it was scary at the end of it. He lay motionless for a long time.
Like I said, it makes Brian Bosworth, what happened to him from Bo Jackson, look PG. Like that, I can't stop hitting replay. Like, it's an 8-second clip that I tweeted out, and I just keep watching it.
And Eric Crouch was immediately in the Heisman discussion after that point. He didn't win it that year, but you know, just as the Nebraska quarterback running for a bunch of yards, that was his highlight. That was the highlight that altered Eric Crouch's career and put him on the national stage, because everybody said, damn, that's the next great Nebraska quarterback right there. He didn't even start this game. Bobby Newcomb started, like I said, didn't do a thing against us in the first half. They moved Bobby Newcomb to wide receiver like the next week, and Eric Crouch was the QB for the
I was just about to ask, why is Eric Crouch in the game at 35-0 in the fourth? But you say he didn't start. Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah, no, Bobby Newcomb started the game, and we held Nebraska, you know, most of the first half. Like, it was 7-0 at halftime. Our defense gets worn down and blah, blah, blah. Nebraska ends up running up big yards once they put Eric Crouch in. We shut Bobby Newcomb down bad enough in the first half. They yank him, put Eric Crouch in, and then Nebraska just took, you know, our offense didn't do a thing, you know, but eventually Nebraska started moving the ball via Eric Crouch, and that was kind of the climactic moment of the game where we were fully demoralized at that point.
Yeah, it was at Kinnick too, right?
It was at Kinnick.
Oh, that's at the house. That was in front of friends and family. That, yeah. He had to go back to school on Monday and answer to that.
Well, he did not go back to on the Good field participation. God. I've never seen it before where he literally had a welt on his head. I still to this day, we've never been able to figure out how it was physiologically possible where a welt was on his head once he took his helmet off, and he couldn't put his helmet on for the rest of the following week, so he couldn't play in the next game because his head was welted by Eric Crouch. I don't know how it's possible through a helmet. It's one thing to get a concussion, but to have a visible welt on the side of your forehead, I've never seen that before, and I've seen a lot of football.
That's Anthony Herron. I'm Nick Szczepkowski. What's the most demoralizing thing that can happen in a team sport? 312-644-6767. This hour being brought to you by Continental Motors. Searching for a used car, search ContinentalMotors.com for the Continental Difference. 312-644-6767. Bensonville and Pete next up on the score tonight. What's up, Pete?
Hi. What Hi. About Minnesota Viking Jim Marshall picking up a fumble and running the wrong way?
Oh, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I think it's embarrassing. I think it's an all-time like football folly. Even to this day, you see Jim Marshall, who, forget the fact that he played and was the most consecutive games in NFL history until far.
He had the streak going.
Like, forget that. Forget that he was a Hall of Fame talent. He's remembered for running the wrong way in terms of demoralizing,
and
though.
He was also like a... Was he like a state level Supreme Court justice or something like that? He was a judge. Also,
session now. Yeah, here so comes
he,
a judge.
He did a bunch of stuff. But I think it kind of depends on how the game itself went as well. Because like the Leon Lett thing, I think is overplayed from the Super Bowl because the Cowboys were out
by 50.
Yeah. So who cares that he got caught by Don Beebe from behind where he was showboating? He had a right to showboat. They were up by 50 points. The Leon Lett thing doesn't bother me. I don't see why that was viewed as this. The great folly of the history of not just Super Bowls. People talk about it as this great dumb moment from football games in general.
Well, was so that the same year that Leon Lett had the dumbass play on Thanksgiving,
no,
though?
It was like a year or two later when the Thanksgiving thing was much worse because they lost the game because
of
it.
Time.
That was far worse than what he did in the Super Bowl.
Where it's, and if you're unfamiliar, and you, why would you be familiar with it? Let's face it. We're just a bunch of sports geeks that remember this stuff, but the Cowboys obviously play every year on Thanksgiving. It happened to be a very snowy game against the Miami Dolphins, and the Cowboys blocked the kick, the game-winning field goal attempt. They escape, and they're going to walk out with a victory as the ball's kind of spinning out, and it's going to be called dead. Leon Lett jumps on the ball, punches it forward. The Dolphins retain possession because of it. They re-kick the ball, goes through the uprights from the leg of Pete Stoyanovich of Indiana fame. The Dolphins walk out with a win and all-time dumbass play. Like, if you're Don Beebe, though, like, how do you remember that play? Not quitting in a Super Bowl? Or is it like, yeah, I made that play, but we still lost 52-17?
Yeah, I mean, I guess
like,
because
how
everybody,
do you remember
else,
it?
Everybody else overhypes it so much that I would think Don Beebe remembers it fondly. I hope if I'm Leon Lett, anytime somebody has the nerve to bring it up, you do some sort of a scoreboard reminder of people that we were up by 180 points. So who the hell cares if Don Beebe ran me down from behind?
Yeah, I wonder how like Don Beebe would look at that. Because obviously it's the ultimate like bulletin board material or motivational tactic of like, hey, hell or high water, you don't quit. You don't quit on a play. You don't quit on anything. So there's that. But it's also like, yeah, thanks for reminding me and getting to the Super Bowl and losing by 52. Like, I wonder how he would take that, like, when he sees a replay of it. 312-644-6767, Midway. Brian, you're next up on the score. What's up, Brian?
Okay, so I remember kind of along the lines of the last caller. I remember there was a high school basketball game, and the kid shot the ball in the wrong hoop. And that was like some kind of a championship game. And that kid will not be able to live this down the rest of his life.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah. I remember, God, this is like Uncle Rico throw a log on the fire type of stuff. I remember, I think it was seventh grade basketball. I sucked at basketball. I was no damn good at basketball. So I rode the bench. It was a miracle I ever made a basketball team. But finally get in the first game of the season in seventh grade. Like, all right, 20-point game with 5 minutes left. We can let this idiot
get Shep some run.
Let this goofy-looking kid in. So I go in with the rest of our third-teamers, you know, practice players, B-teamers, whatever you want to call us.
The bench mob.
That's right. We're great at keeping stats, keeping each other entertained during the games. So I get in, and we're up big against Dwight. Starting the season against Dwight. And opposing team makes a free throw, and I take the ball out of bounds to throw it to my teammate, Drew Fries. Like, all right, let's go score some points ourselves. And he immediately puts it in the hoop. And I'm thinking, wait, hold on. Do I try to block that? Like, what do we do? And he makes a layup
put
for
Drew's
the other
name
team.
Out there, huh?
And it's okay. Like, oh, my God. Well, he lives in Utah now. If he gets any word of this, then it would be a minor miracle in itself. I think that he's moved on to bigger and better things with
or
his life.
Or he might be out clubbing on a Friday
night
instead of listening to us. Anyway.
But I just remember thinking, like, do I try to block a teammate? Like, what line do you draw?
There,
like, he starts to go to take the layup, and it's just kind of like, Drew, oh, God, man. I remember our coach at the post game when we're sitting in the locker room, like, yeah, we're 1-0. Don't you dare make fun of him at school tomorrow. Don't say a word. Yeah. It's like, I tried to block his shot.
I'm not supposed to have to play defense on you, Drew. That's not how it's supposed to go.
Demoralizing, but man, embarrassing as hell. No doubt about that. Portage, Indiana. Dan, what's your story of demoralization on a sporting field? What's up, Dan?
Hey, man, I gotta say, when Sanchez runs into his lineman and fumbles the ball, I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that for that guy's career.
Yeah, because what year was that?
Stay with him forever, the butt fumble. I mean, as happy as Jets fans are right now that Sam Darnold went in and apparently lit it up for their preseason opener tonight. So they're very excited. They have reason to be. I think he's going to be a special talent. But the butt fumble, it's going to take a lot. Sam Darnold's going to have to do quite a bit for Jets fans to feel like the butt fumble is completely in their rearview mirror, because Mark Sanchez was a first-round pick. And Mark Sanchez took him to a couple AFC championship games in his first two seasons. And then from there, the wheels fell off the wagon, and they never got back on there. And the butt fumble was just – that was kind of the – that was the climactic moment that took the career of Mark Sanchez in a completely different direction. Nobody cared about him being here just as a supportive backup QB in the past. They cared about, you know what, why did we bring butt fumble guy to Chicago?
Yeah, that's what he's always known as. And that's right, he took the Jets to conference title games as a rookie in 2009.
First 2 years. Yeah.
Second year in the league in 2010.
He was winning games in the National Football League. He looked like a future star. I mean, he was a current star. It looked like that star was going to continue to rise.
And 2 seasons later, not even 2 years later, but 2 seasons later is the butt fumble where it's, I mean, is there a word? Somebody brought up Jim Marshall running the wrong way. Is there a more embarrassing thing to happen on a football field? I know the Eric Crouch play we've been referencing throughout the night. Like, on an NFL playing surface, is there something more embarrassing that's ever happened to a player than Mark Sanchez? Yeah. Like, everything. The handoff goes the wrong way, tries to run it, make something out of nothing himself, run into his lineman's ass, fumbling. Like, I don't know if there's anything more embarrassing. Plainfield, Gary, you're next up on the score. What's demoralizing in the world of sports for you, Gary?
I got a good one for you. It was Monday Night Football years ago. Steve McNair, I think it was Tennessee versus Baltimore, I believe. Steve McNair, you know, he's running. He runs the ball. You know, he scrambles. He's running towards the sidelines. He's slowing up, you know, to go out of bounds. A defensive back comes up and tries to hit him. Steve McNair lowers his shoulder. The guy's helmet comes off. Legs go up in the air. He hits the ground. And now he's laying on his back, you know, raising his arm up, trying to get some feeling back in his arm like he has a stinger. That was like, definitely demoralizing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Like, I think those are the plays that just, you're left questioning, like, everything in life of just, man, especially at, like, the NFL or big-time college football, when it happens and it's on national TV and you're just left with, oh, God. All my friends and family were watching.
Yeah.
Like, it was cool to have the support of an entire town and all my classmates, but they just saw that happen to me. Like, who was it for the Bears a couple of years ago? When they lost to the – was it Chris Conte? When they lost to the Bills in week one, there's a play that I think set up either the game-winning field goal or game-winning touchdown in overtime where the receiver makes a play, and I mean, Chris Conte is trying to make a tackle.
Oh, okay.
And it goes on for like 25-30 yeah. yards where Chris Conte's got his hands on the runner and he's trying to bring him down, and this guy like literally has just a stiff arm out. And it's like when you're in high school and you're picking on your cousin who's like in fourth grade and you just kind of like keep your hand away and you're like, yep, keep fighting me. Like that's what Chris Conte looked like. And it was like, man, he's got a family to go home to tonight. Like his mom's going to call and ask him or tell him that he played a good game and has to lie to him and say like, I'm proud of you, son, even after that.
Sweetie,
like,
you did so well. Like,
yeah, we're so proud of you, kid. Oh boy, is this awkward. But yeah, so hopefully that was some fun for you. You had one that like stuck out for like you have like one memory at Iowa or Bolingbrook or in the NFL that especially stuck out that like pertained to the. I mean, you shared the Iowa run by Eric Crouch.
The Matt Unertle thing from Wisconsin when they blew us out. Matt Unertle certainly didn't light me up, but individually. As a defensive lineman, just when the opposing quarterback, once you make a great move and you get home on a rush and you light him up, and you tend to think when you give a guy your best shot that they're probably going to not get up sometimes. And that was kind of how I thought of myself as a hitter. I was a decent hitter. But Joe Germain, actually Mike Chen had to remind me of his name on Twitter. It was Ohio State came to Kinnick in like 98.
Was he drunk? Wasn't that a thing with Joe Germain?
Could have been.
I thought he got a DUI.
No, that was the quarterback that I mentioned first, Steve Belisari.
Ah, Steve Belisari, maybe? Belisari?
No, Belisari. I spelled it wrong, but yeah, I spelled it right.
On purpose, right. Yes. I got you. But Joe Germain was not a big dude, probably smaller than Eric Crouch, and I was just lighting him up when the Buckeyes came to Kinnick one night. And for whatever reason, I kept giving him my best stuff, and he was wearing rib protectors and all that. But Joe Germain was a tough little sucker because he just kept getting up. Now, he wasn't talking smack or anything. He'd just get up very calmly, sometimes very gingerly, stroll on back to the huddle, and call the next play. That was probably a demoralizing sort of thing when you really feel like you dig into a quarterback and you're thinking, this dude ain't getting up. And he kept getting up and going back to the huddle over and over again.
Yeah, that's rough when you're like, I'm big and tough, and this guy's just as tough. This segment brought to you by Spot Hero. And finally, here's a way you can save time parking. Use Spot Hero anytime you park. First-time users can enter promo code SMART for $10 off. Spot Hero, park smarter. Have a great weekend, dude. We got a big week next week.
Yeah, we do. A lot happening for us. What, Monday and Tuesday night next week?
Yeah, we're in for Lawrence Holmes. So a lot more of this to come. Monday and Tuesday nights for Anthony Heron. Thank you tonight, Mike Chen, Herb Lawrence, our producers. Julie DeCaro coming up next. For Anthony Heron, I'm Nick Szczepkowski. Have a great rest of your Friday night. Keep listening. Julie DeCaro coming up next on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.